Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we hear the backstory about the downfall of a decorated narcotics officer and former deputy chief of police in Fresno.
And later, we talk to women on the front lines of fighting human trafficking and gender-based pay discrimination in the Valley.
But first, health insurance is back in national headlines now that the Justice Department has voiced its support for striking down the Affordable Care Act. It's provided insurance and reduced coverage gaps for tens of millions of Americans. So what can happen to patients without adequate access to care? Here's the story of one Porterville man brought to the brink of death by a rare, often misdiagnosed disease. About 5 years ago, Jesus Gomez spent a month in the hospital. As he pulls out his phone to show me photos, he stops and smiles.
Te vas a asustar.
They'll scare me, he jokes, as he pulls up pictures of his head and torso covered in red splotches and thick brown scabs. His daughter Jessica Gomez translates.
Si no me hubieran atendido, yo hubiera muerto. Tuviera 5 años de muerto.
He would have been 5 years of his death if they wouldn't have treated him.
His symptoms started small in 2013.
Me empezó como, me daba como comezón.
It started off, he would get itchy, and when he would scratch, it would break the skin, and then his skin would peel.
Eran como bolitas de agua.
They were like little blisters.
He tried to wait it out. The Mexican restaurant where he worked 6 days a week didn't provide insurance and didn't allow him sick time. But he knew he needed to see a doctor when blisters had broken out on his chest and back.
Me hicieron una biopsia y me dijeron que era alergia.
He was paying for all that out of pocket because he didn't have insurance, and they did a biopsy and they told him it was an allergy.
But the allergy medication he was prescribed didn't work. Neither did another doctor's treatment for psoriasis. Without insurance, other doctors turned him away and emergency rooms failed to connect him with a specialist. He felt neglected and discarded.
Pensé que no tenía cura yo.
He thought, you know, is there no cure for what I have? You know, he was frustrated because he didn't know what he had, and he seen that he wasn't getting any better and no one was helping him.
By early 2014, after almost a year of being misdiagnosed, Gomez's skin was oozing and bloody. He'd lost his hair. His daughter Jessica was 22 at the time. She once remembers having to cut his shirt off, and a lot of his skin came off with it.
Because he had a lot of pus that would come out, so he smelled literally like his body was rotting, like if he was dead.
Did you worry about that? Were you worried that you were dying?
Sí.
One night in February 2014, his ex-wife called a family friend who was a nurse. When she saw that he was shaking, feverish, his limbs swollen with water, she rushed him to the ER at Cahuilla Delta Medical Center. The last thing Gomez remembers is signing paperwork, probably for the emergency Medi-Cal coverage he should have been given earlier. He woke up the next day at Community Regional Medical Center, where he had been transported to the intensive care unit for burn victims.
Well, I walked into the burn unit and I saw a man who had probably maybe 5% of the skin on his entire body intact. He was, basically looking like someone that was on his deathbed.
That's Dr. Greg Simpson, a dermatologist at Community Regional and UCSF Fresno. Almost immediately, he recognized the signs of pemphigus vulgaris, an autoimmune disease in which the immune system attacks its own skin cells.
The way we think about a lot of these autoimmune diseases is they're like a light switch. Something happened that turned this light switch on, and that light switch is on until we do something to turn it back off.
The only treatment that works is chemotherapy. Gomez needed a month of it before he was released. It's no wonder allergy drugs didn't work. The disease is really rare, just a few cases in every 500,000 people. But Simpson says he remembers those patients clearly because their cases are so severe.
They're taking a lot longer to sort of get picked up by the system and treated, and they're just seen way farther along than they should be.
Why? The best doctors to make the diagnosis are dermatologists, but not all specialists treat Medi-Cal patients or the uninsured. They're expensive. And the San Joaquin Valley is chronically underserved by all doctors, particularly specialists. Today, Jesus Gomez keeps the disease at bay with chemo infusions once or twice a year. He calls Dr. Simpson a gift from God. He lives with his kids now and two nephews, and that's meaningful for his daughter Jessica, who heard stories of her mother's postpartum depression when she was born.
My dad was the one who kind of had to step in and take care of me because my mom wasn't able to, and so I felt like it got reversed and I got to pay him back.
He can't work, and his skin still breaks out in harsh sunlight and heat, but every morning he can, he tends to his garden. He grows herbs and vegetables. There's the branch he stuck in the ground that grew into a blackberry tree, and the rose bush he shaped into a heart. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
One of the biggest scandals in modern California's law enforcement history took place right here in Fresno. It's the story of former Deputy Chief of Police Keith Foster. Foster was a local success story, a decorated narcotics officer once shot in the line of duty. He rose up the ranks right behind Chief Jerry Dyer and had a chance of taking over the force one day. Instead, he's sitting in federal prison in Colorado. From member station KQED's The California Report magazine, reporter Robert Lewis has this story.
Most people think of the Central Valley as one of the biggest agricultural areas in the country, but it's also a major hub for illegal drugs. And Keith Foster was part of the fight to crack down on them.
The cultivation and distribution of marijuana is a national concern.
This is Foster at a 2011 city council meeting in which he pushes officials to crack down on outdoor marijuana grow sites.
72% of all the marijuana grown in the United States is grown in California. So that's significant.
Foster's father was a church deacon. His sister, Kelly Foster Nellum, is a former president of the local NAACP. She says their dad instilled discipline and a call to serve, a call her brother answered.
Keith graduated at 15. He had his whole life mapped out. He said, I'm going to go to the academy. I'm going to be a police officer. And he did that. He did everything that he stated that he wanted to do. And he made my dad proud.
That's why so many people were shocked when they heard Deputy Chief Foster was arrested. Bill Ruzumeni is the federal drug czar for the region. He's known Foster for years, knew him to be a good cop and an ally in the fight against drugs. Ruzumeni heard about the arrest from one of his commanders.
I think I said something like, really? And how do we know? And then they told me about the wiretap.
Hello? Man, I've been calling you. Why didn't you call me back yesterday?
That's Keith Foster. He'd been struggling with really serious money problems for some time, including a costly divorce. He even borrowed $15,000 from a subordinate. Red flags. But the probe appears to have started almost by accident. Federal agents with the FBI and ATF were investigating a drug ring they thought might be helping fuel some of the Fresno area's gang violence. One of the tapped phones belonged to a suspected dealer, Keith Foster's nephew, Denny Foster. When Keith Foster got on the line, agents realized it wasn't just a family call. Here he is talking about paying more than $3,000 for three units, which allegedly refers to drugs.
Okay, so you're saying get $3,200 from my boy and you can get three units.
In December 2014, after listening to these calls, federal investigators took the stunning step of starting a wiretap on Foster, the second highest-ranking officer in the Fresno Police Department. And over a three-month period, what they heard was troubling evidence that Foster was involved in trafficking not just marijuana, but also heroin and prescription painkillers.
Hey, remember what we talked about, man, the black?
Prosecutors say that the black he's talking about is a kind of heroin. This was from a call between Keith Foster and a convicted street gang member who says it's $1,000 for the best, called China White.
Yeah, we're talking about some China White, though. You know what I mean?
Hey, you ain't got to go into all that. Just meet me.
In another call, Foster talks to a nephew's girlfriend. She tells him the nephew was pulled over and arrested after Highway Patrol searched the car and found marijuana.
He had 6 pounds on him, and he told them he had 6 pounds.
Foster tells her he'll call his own narc guys, meaning the narcotics officers he had sway with.
I'm going to call my narc guys. See, if he would have told me, oh, look, okay, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, then I would have some cover for it. But it's like,
At the same time as Foster is allegedly committing crimes, the wiretap also captures calls where he talks about grappling with the city's rampant crime.
You know, think about this kind of job. We got a whole lot of stuff going on. We had somebody break into a church and do some hate crimes. You know, I got 3 shootings. I mean, it's crazy.
Foster's family has largely rallied around him and wants to clear his name. They think he was targeted so forcefully, in part because of his race. Some background. This is a city where only about 8% of the population is black. Last year, a financial news and opinion website dubbed the city one of the worst to live in for African Americans, based on the level of segregation and mortality rates. So the fact Foster made it to the top of the department in a city where it seems a black man is more likely to be shot by police than to lead them was a big deal. This was a department where in the 1920s, more than half a dozen officers were revealed to be members of the Ku Klux Klan. Chief Dyer has been sued multiple times for discrimination by his own officers. Among the allegations, he liked to sing the antebellum song, Mammy's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread, when talking about black people.
The gray house, it used to be yellow when we lived there, but that's where we lived.
On a recent afternoon, Foster's sister, Kelly Foster Nellum, drove me around the southwest Fresno neighborhood where they grew up, trying to make sense of how we got here. The Fosters are one of the most prominent families in the area. Keith Foster has 13 siblings, including an older brother who once went 15 rounds with Muhammad Ali. A police substation in the area is named after their father. The family has also had its share of pain. A nephew, Eric, was actually shot and killed 16 years ago by Fresno police. Eric was reportedly a robbery suspect. He was shot multiple times in the back in a dark orchard on the edge of town. Turned out he was unarmed.
The little yellow stand thing right there that's sticking out, you see the little stick thing right there? That's the marker where Eric's mom made a makeshift memorial for him.
Kelly says the shooting caused a rift in the family, and some relatives blamed her brother Keith Foster for not getting involved in the ensuing protests, choosing badge over family. She thinks that's why he ended up in trouble.
We continue to follow breaking news. The second highest ranking officer in Fresno arrested in a federal drug conspiracy investigation. That is our top story tonight at 6. Good evening.
At trial, Foster's lawyer argued that all that talk about drugs was just Foster gathering intelligence, like an undercover officer might do. And he suggested Foster was implicated in the case because Denny, the nephew caught on the wiretap, was trying to save his own neck. Foster's sister says Denny still blamed Foster for not siding with the family after Eric was killed.
Denny has had it in for my brother. He was the one that kind of started that rift in the family with respect to Uncle, you know, sided with the cops over family kind of thing.
The jury didn't buy it.
Breaking news.
Fresno's former deputy police chief, a man once in a position of trust, walked out of court with his family Tuesday after being found guilty of federal drug trafficking charges.
The jury found Foster guilty for his role in the heroin and marijuana conspiracies. Early last year, Deputy Chief Keith Foster started a 4-year sentence in federal prison in Colorado. He's appealing the conviction and did not respond to an interview request. Chief Dyer said at a press conference after the arrest, he was shocked.
I spend 60 to 70 hours a week as the police chief in the city. Consider myself to be extremely hands-on. Deputy Chief Foster's office is just a few feet away from mine.
But he didn't exactly promise a top-to-bottom review of the department.
I think it is a sad day when we allow an isolated incident to cause us to lose confidence in mankind. And I refuse to do that.
But to actually know whether it's an isolated incident, you probably have to dig deeper, which is why it's worth pointing out. Foster's nephew told prosecutors the deputy chief was helping deal marijuana for 7 years. The federal investigation into Deputy Chief Foster lasted all of 4 months, enough time to get him off the street and into prison, not enough to actually answer the question, if the number two in the department is running a drug ring, what else is going on?
That was reporter Robert Lewis. He's been looking into the Fresno Police Department as part of the California Corruption Project out of the Investigative Reporting Program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Here he is speaking with the California Report magazine's host, Sasha Coca. And later, he takes a tour through Fresno's bootlegging past with writer Mark Arax.
Robert, you know, one of the things that's amazing to me as I'm listening to your story is that this Foster case, it's the kind of scandal that would bring down so many other leaders. How did Chief Dyer not suspect something? I mean, it wasn't only the money problems. I understand there were other questions, like allegations that Foster sexually harassed another cop's wife, even child abuse allegations that came out during Foster's divorce.
There were investigations into the sexual harassment and child abuse, and he was cleared. But taken together, it seems like there should have been deeper scrutiny.
And as we've said, we both spent months trying to get Chief Dyer to do an interview with us, but he refused. He did speak to some graduate students from the UC Berkeley School of Journalism last year for a story about racial disparities in policing. But he did so only on the condition they not ask him about the Foster case.
No, I think you guys asked about everything. There's other things you could have asked, and I'm glad you didn't, but I already hopefully shared with him why I wasn't going to reopen that wound either. But
this isn't the only wound, right, Robert? I mean, I know Dyer called Foster's arrest an isolated incident. Was it?
No, it wasn't. More than a dozen Fresno police officers have been arrested in recent years, including some big corruption busts. There was a Fresno drug unit investigated for allegedly running a stolen car parts ring. There was a vice detective convicted in federal court for taking bribes to help a major drug dealer. And there was a cartel-connected cop found with meth in his house. He was allowed to stay on the force, only to be caught years later with a stolen truck outfitted to smuggle drugs. That officer was finally fired and is now facing criminal charges in local court.
Wow. I mean, I understand there were a lot of questions about the way those cases were handled and if anything was ever done after them to change things. I mean, this is a city that spent a decade even debating whether or not the police needed an independent auditor.
And the position doesn't exactly have a lot of sway. For example, after Foster's arrest, the auditor recommended more financial disclosure, especially for officers seeking promotions. It just didn't happen. Retired Lieutenant Dennis Montano is former head of internal affairs. He agreed to speak to me on the outskirts of the city. Montano was frank in his assessment. The department too often treats corruption cases as isolated incidents.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe they did that. That's horrible. I can't imagine anybody else doing that. And then somebody else does it.
I asked him if the department does proactive internal affairs investigations, basically stings to keep people honest.
In Fresno, no. No. In some agencies, they do. Like, for example, the LA Police Department, they have what they call, I think it's called the Integrity Unit, where they'll basically maybe place a wallet with, you know, $100 of cash in it.
And then see if the officer turns in the wallet or keeps it.
Yeah, Los Angeles started doing things like that after a big corruption scandal. Oakland's police department did the same. I asked why Fresno doesn't do that.
That's the chief's decision.
And we should mention here, Chief Dyer himself has never been accused of corruption. And he is widely respected in law enforcement circles. So why isn't he doing more to address these kind of scandals?
You know, as I talk to people for this story, eventually every conversation will get to the point where they just sort of shrug and say, that's Fresno.
As a reporter there, that's something I would hear all the time. When there would be questionable police shootings, there were just a handful of activists who would speak out. For a long time in Fresno, there was no ACLU. There was no police watchdog group.
This is a city that had some of the biggest bootlegging scandals during Prohibition. There were big mob murders half a century ago. In the 70s, the feds apparently wouldn't even share info with the Fresno PD because they didn't trust them.
I mean, there is so much history in Fresno that people in the rest of the state just don't know about. And Robert, you did a walking tour of Fresno's past with somebody who was a pretty good guide.
Yeah, Mark Arax is arguably the foremost writer and historian of the Central Valley. He spent 17 years as a reporter at the LA Times, has written books.
He also grew up here, and he's got his own tragic family story, which we're going to hear about a little later.
When I started working on this story, I reached out to him. He said to understand how we got here, a deputy chief sitting in prison, I had to literally go with him to see the history of Fresno, what's there, and what the city is trying to forget. It's a Saturday morning just a few blocks from downtown Fresno.
So this is Chinatown.
This is Chinatown.
Eric's and I are joining a tour group led by a local Chinatown Historical Association. And we're about to go underground, the site of one's secret tunnels from the early 1900s.
I'm curious to see them. I've never been down there.
Let's go check it out.
Yeah.
The tour guide leads us through a barber shop on the corner of F and Kern Street, past people getting haircuts, to a dark stairwell in the back leading underground.
Take a deep breath.
It's steep. We need the flashlights and our iPhones to find our way.
These are part of the tunnel network that connected Chinatown, extended 17 blocks.
We end up in what looks like a series of connected basements, and there are ancient sealed doorways and spots. Down here a century ago, this room would have been partitioned off and filled with beds for prostitutes. The tunnels would have connected with drug dens and gambling rooms.
It was accepted as part of the way of doing business.
Eric says the police condoned it and even took a cut of the proceeds. And he says to understand this place, you have to understand the vice, the corruption, the world that existed in these shadows.
This is not only a secret passageway in Fresno, it's the history is a secret as well.
Many of these tunnels have been destroyed, and Eric says the city hasn't done enough to protect its historical landmarks. As we come up, Eric says during Prohibition, Fresno moved on from the opium and became a hotspot for illegal alcohol. And again, the police were involved. In the mid-20s, a dozen Fresno cops, including the chief, were indicted for their role in what Eric calls the biggest bootlegging scandal of the era.
Fresno was listed among the prohibition agencies, federal prohibition agencies, as the wettest county in the western United States, if not the nation.
Eric thinks this is because the Central Valley is cut off, literally and psychologically, from much of the state. And it developed with an eclectic mix of people. Germans from Russia, former Confederate soldiers, Dust Bowl migrants, Armenians fleeing the Turkish genocide, people largely distrustful of too much government and oversight. In this freewheeling way, they built a thriving city.
Fresno kind of was a little bit like a miniature San Francisco. It had nice architecture, nice buildings, a real sense, a vibrant sense of a cohesive downtown. That's all been ripped out. A lot of it's been ripped out.
One of the few places that hasn't been is downtown on Broadway. It was the place to be during the 1940s.
So we're standing in front of, what is this, a six-story
building? This is Hotel Fresno, one of the fanciest hotels. My parents had their wedding reception here in 1956. And look at it now. It's just...
Oh, the paint's peeling. Yeah. It looks like all the windows are boarded up with
But it's been, yeah, it's been emptied out.
But back in the day, there was music, dancing, gambling, prostitution. The vice here was controlled by the Los Angeles mob, much of it centered just down the block from the Fresno Hotel at a night spot called the Plantation Club.
And the way up to the Plantation Club was a secret elevator that was manned by a Fresno police sergeant. And the police headquarters was just catty corner here.
Eric says there's evidence a member of the Fresno Police Department actually drove down to Los Angeles every couple weeks to give the mobsters their cut of the action. Then Eric takes me several blocks away, where the history turns personal. We are standing in the parking lot of the old bar Eric's dad, Ara, used to own. You'd never know now from the heavy locked door and trash thrown about that this was the hottest club in town. Chuck Berry once duck walked across this stage. As a kid, Eric's dad would put him to work here.
He was so fastidious, he'd make me take the chewing gum off from underneath the tables, the bar tables.
One Sunday night in 1972, two men from Detroit walked into this bar looking for his dad.
My dad was seated in his office chair when the first bullet was fired, grazing the top of his head, going through that wall and landing right here in this parking lot.
Ara Erex's murder was unsolved for decades. Mark Erex spent years investigating the killing and wrote a book about it, laying out a theory that his dad was murdered by contract killers before he could expose major drug traffickers and the Fresno police who protected them. After the book, one of the shooters was arrested and convicted in what was portrayed in court as simply a robbery gone bad. Erex is skeptical, says Fresno is a long way to go for robbers from Detroit.
Before the murder, I was a kid stupid to his place, not unlike, you know, so many other kids.
But he started looking around, uncovering the history.
And it was after the murder that I picked up a tape recorder. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I started asking questions.
in a storage facility. Eric shows me where all those questions have led. A dozen packed file cabinets, boxes stacked on top, filled with federal reports, court documents, and old crime scene photos. Not just his father's murder, but the history of Fresno in the Central Valley.
Okay. Oh, let's see. Book number one. Okay.
Piecing it all together, Eric says he thinks Fresno is one of the most corrupt cities in the country, and often at the center of it, the police.
This is a city now of, you know, when you look at the metropolitan area, 600, 700,000 people. And you know, we had a police chief, how many goes back, maybe just three or four police chiefs who, you know, was married to the biggest madam in Fresno, and no one ever wrote the story. So I think the lesson is that once a place starts off bad, it kind of ends up bad.
Unless, Eric says, there's the will to do something about it. And so learning about the past is really about committing to change the future.
It's not just history, because once this corruption got rooted here, it continued from generation to generation.
From the opium dens to prohibition, the LA mob, 1970s drug runners, to the present, and Police Chief Jerry Dyer's second-in-command, Keith Foster.
Look what the FBI found. You know, they found that the deputy police chief was part of a ring, a drug smuggling ring. It's the deputy police chief. But it harkens back to 1924 and the bootlegging scandal, when the police chief and all his deputies were involved in that scam.
Then, like today, the city seems to have just quietly moved on, suggesting the next Fresno police scandal is not a question of if, but when.
Again, that story comes to us from member station KQED's The California Report magazine and reporter Robert Lewis. Lewis has been looking into the Fresno Police Department as part of the California Corruption Project out of the Investigative Reporting Program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Today is Equal Pay Day, marking the fact that women are often paid less than men for the same job. Take this case in 2013. Eileen Rizzo was working at the Fresno County Office of Education. She found out a male colleague with less education and experience was making more than she was. The reason? Her pay was based on her previous salary. Rizzo ultimately filed suit under the Equal Pay Act and California's sex discrimination statutes. That case is still making its way through the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Reporter Laura Satsui asked Rizzo what this fight ultimately means to her.
At first, really it was just about justice and what I thought was being fair and equal. I have to admit that I wasn't necessarily informed or knowledgeable about the pay gap or what that meant to society or communities. But when that happened to me, it was just really devastating and a time that I had to reflect on how I was going to deal with it. Or all of these options started flooding my mind. And when I just decided to kind of confront it and went to HR, it was really with the idea that I wanted my family to have parity, and that the money I brought home to my family should be equal to the money a man brings home to his family.
And so this case has made its way through the justice system with all of its twists and turns that it could possibly have. Yeah. But where are things right now? So this is, it started in 2013, roughly, and we're 6 years later.
Yes. So it's been quite a long journey. And so the Fresno County Office of Education did end up appealing to the Supreme Court. And when it's appealed, your case sits in a bank of cases where the court has to decide whether or not to take the case. So it was relisted 5 times. So it had to be relisted quite a few times before they actually voted on the case. And what happened was there was a technicality in the decision. So when the case was decided, Judge Reinhart, who wrote the decision and voted on the case, passed away before it was filed.
And that was on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, right?
Yes, that's correct. And so because he passed away before it was filed, the Supreme Court has decided to send it back to the Ninth Circuit to be re-voted on and re-decided on, which is not anything that decides on the merit of the case, but just the technicality of what happened unexpectedly in his passing.
And I understand, though, at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, before that person passed away, they voted in your favor, right?
Yes.
And so at this point, I mean, are you expecting that to happen again, that you'll still win?
Yes. So we're very positive that we'll still get a positive ruling on our favor. It was a unanimous vote when it was there. So 11 justices agreed that prior salary can't be used to justify a wage disparity. So we're confident that will happen. I think what's discouraging is the amount of time that now this adds to this journey. And so sending it back to the courts probably adds roughly a year or 2 years before it could be again appealed to the Supreme Court and then wait for their decision on the merits of the case.
And not only have you been the face and figure in sort of your lawsuit and fighting for equal pay, but you also ran for office last year in 2018 against Republican incumbent Jim Patterson for state assembly. Jim Patterson kept his seat, but I'm really curious. I mean, did you see running for office as a part of your broader campaign and fight for equal pay as well?
Well, they were definitely connected because it was my advocacy work around making the economic security of women stronger in our state that I was working on bills that would do those things. And my desire was that I would be able to do whatever I can so that no woman would have to ever walk in my shoes. It was that work that made me aware of our current representation in his voting record with bills like this and all the bills surrounding not only equal pay for equal work, but sexual harassment and childcare, things, lactation accommodations, things like that, where I was discouraged on his voting record. So my desire was really to give constituents the opportunity to have a choice.
So while you didn't win that seat, but you, like you mentioned, had been doing advocacy for legislation that, increases gender parity in the workplace in a number of ways. Can you talk about some of the other wins that you have had regarding equal pay here in the state of California?
So, yes. Yeah, so I think the first greatest victory we had was in 2015, and the California Fair Pay Act was signed. And that allowed workers to talk about their pay, for discrepancies to be based on business reasons and nothing else. And it really just closed a lot of the loopholes that even the Equal Pay Act that secures a whole nation under that law, but really tried to close the loopholes. It defined what equal work meant. So equal work is substantially similar work, whether or not you have the same title or you're at the same location. So that was a great asset to the tools that women need, and hopefully that employers are held accountable so that women don't have to file lawsuits, because a lot of women don't have that choice. You know, it takes a lot of money to fight a case like this. And when you think about 40% of households depend on a working woman's paycheck, that paycheck doesn't have room for attorney retainer fees. So that was one of the great victories that we had. And then a few legislation sessions ago, we also had the opportunity to finally pass a bill that kept employers from asking for your prior salary. So you can offer the information if you think it's in your favor, but it can't be asked on an application or in an interview. And we really feel that the pay gap is being perpetuated by that question and the use of prior salary. We can close that gap purposefully by targeting that very question. And so that was one of the successes that we had in our state to protect.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Why is it that asking for prior salary might put women at a disadvantage?
So when the Equal Pay Act was created in 1963, women were being paid less for doing the same job. The intent was that the law would now protect women, but there's that clause in there that says any other factor. And any other factor has been exploited to be any other reason you could find to pay a woman less than a man. And so if a woman is discriminated any time before she goes seeks a new employer, when they ask for the previous salary, then we know that that is going to be perpetuated no matter what happens later on to her, that she carries that burden of that low wage.
So being that typically women, you know, are offered a lower salary than men, and
yes.
don't necessarily bargain or you know, ask for more and ultimately Absolutely. Just receive a lower salary, yeah. perhaps.
And the American Association of University of Women have done a lot of reports that and research around the idea that when women have the same degree and then go out into the workforce, they're more likely to get less pay than their male counterparts are already outset from their college degree.
Mm. And so you still work in education. In a practical sense, how do you talk to women about equal pay? Do you have any practical advice for encouraging them to seek that and ultimately get it?
Yes. So I think one of the powers that we have is just to know our rights, to be knowledgeable about the protections that we have. You know, the California Fair Pay Act brought more protections and tools to women, but unless we enforce those and know about them, we kind of think that we're still barred from talking about our salary or we're scared to do certain things. So if you know your rights, you're able to stand a little firmer on solid ground. If you think someone's being paid more than you and there's no reason like education, experience, merit, seniority to justify that, you now have the right to go ask that person, you know, how much are you getting paid? You have the right to go to HR and ask them to investigate your question. And whether or not it turns out to be true, you can have no retaliation against you. So even just lifting a veil and making things more transparent really allows a woman to like stand her ground. I also tell women to know their worth. So when you go in for a job, know how much that job is being paid in that area and with the experience that you have, and never short sell yourself. Always stand firm with that. I think that we leave a lot of money on the table, but what we have to do is really stand firm. We have to make that the norm. Until that's the norm, then people won't know how to react. I think sometimes women are retaliated against if we're too pushy or too strong or, you know, whatever other characteristics they like to put on that. But we need to make that the new norm, that that's okay for a woman to do. We are providing for our families. We're providing for our futures, our retirement. That's worth equal to a man. So we need to make sure that we know that.
And so we've already sort of mentioned that this lawsuit is still working its way through things. And so that's what you're also still working on as, mm-hmm. and along with being in education. But are you considering maybe running for office again? I mean, what might be next for you?
So I'm still keeping that definitely an open door. I really learned a lot. And I think that the most important thing that I learned is how constituents want to be listened to. Their voices need to be heard. And too often, lobbyists and companies and big organizations are the loudest voices in the room of our representation. That really shouldn't happen, and that's really discouraging for me. And so I'm really keeping my options open. Right now I'm working on a PhD in STEM education. I'm due to finish that in 2021. So I'm not sure exactly where I'll be in 2020, but I'm really keeping my options open and really want to continue to be civically engaged in ways that I can uplift my community.
Okay, we've been talking to Eileen Rizzo. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, Fresno Mayor Lee Brand introduced a new initiative aimed at combating a huge problem here in the Valley: human trafficking. The initiative brings together city government, law enforcement, and aid organizations, many of which have been addressing trafficking for years. Today in our studio, we hear from Miko Anderson, a senior deputy district attorney with the County of Fresno, and Deborah Rush, founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Breaking the Chains. So Miko, let's start with you. What kind of trafficking happens in the San Joaquin Valley today, and how common is it?
Well, there are so many different types of trafficking, and we believe to some degree they all happen within the San Joaquin Valley. There's the international trafficking, there's labor trafficking, as well as sex trafficking, and for the most part that is domestic. The trafficking that is at least reported most is the domestic sex trafficking, and those are the cases that I work most frequently.
And when you say domestic, I mean that means that those are people who are American being trafficked by other Americans.
Absolutely.
And so the district attorney's office itself created a human trafficking task force a few years ago. So tell me about how that works.
Well, the Human Trafficking Task Force is one that meets at one of the offices at the District Attorney's Office, and it includes several different agencies, federal agencies, state agencies, non-governmental agencies, and the purpose is so we can get together and come up with either a common attack or a comprehensive plan to attack the human trafficking. And then there's a portion of that task force meeting that's law enforcement only, so we can exchange intel and figure out the best way to combat some of the specific challenges we might have in our cases.
And how much, you know, what proportion of these cases actually end up being prosecuted?
It's really difficult to quantify. Because the way it works is not all trafficking cases get reported to law enforcement. So I only see the ones that actually get reported to law enforcement. By the time they get reported to law enforcement, there's generally enough evidence that I would pick up the case and file it for prosecution. But the part that happens that's out of law enforcement's view, that part, I kind of don't have the data on because it doesn't get reported.
How big a region does the San Joaquin Valley appear to be when it comes to trafficking compared to others? I mean, is it as common here as we might see elsewhere, or is it more common?
I feel like, and this is not necessarily statistic-based, that it is more common here. And the reason I say that, because I've gone through several trainings that pull in people from other offices, different part of the state, and even different part of the country. And at least as far as California goes, when it comes to other law enforcement agencies, it was to the point where we were being approached. And they were questioning us on why they were getting so many of our either sex traffickers or victims there in their county. So because of our location being so centrally located, a lot of it, it's grown here. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that seems to be exported out to other communities.
Wow. Well, so, Deborah, tell me about what Breaking the Chains does and how that fits into, you know, all this this whole other network of services that exist here in this area.
So we're a 501c3 charitable organization, and we provide residential and non-residential services to juvenile and adult female victims of domestic sex trafficking. We do work with a lot of human trafficking in totality, which means like domestic servitude and labor trafficking, but typically we hold hands in those areas with other partners like Fresno County EOC and Central La Familia. What we do in both of those aspects is we're providing trauma treatment services. So for our residential, it is quite frankly that we have individuals who live on campus with us who also live at other collaborative campuses that we work with. And then for our non-residential, they live in CSEC foster homes, group homes, other shelters or program-like environments, or may just be in an independently healthy living environment that they have prearranged. And then they come Monday through Friday for everything from trauma counseling, life skills workshops, educational courses. We help with job placement, job reintegration. And I think the best way to kind of wrap all that together is we do life. We help them get from the point of rescue into becoming healthy thrivers back in the community and doing what they were originally meant to do before they were knocked off trajectory through this incredibly tragic event.
And Deborah, you yourself are a survivor of human trafficking.
I am.
It was about 20 years ago, if I understand correctly, that you were rescued from those circumstances. Mm-hmm. I mean, how does that experience inform what you do?
Oh, 100% it informs what we do. It informs what we do because in 1999, when I was rescued, the blanket attempt was made to relocate me to Northern California. There were no services that were provided. I've coined the phrase a teacup method was placed in my life, which means it was kind of not talked about, right? You are rescued, you're out of the situation, you're here, you're safe. Now let's just move on with life. Let's kind of dust your knees off. For me, there was a faith-based aspect, so I was told to just go to the altar, give it to Jesus, right? And everything's going to be great. But that's not what happened. I started experiencing, very soon afterwards, I started experiencing what we now know as compound complex PTSD. I was having trouble operating in public. I was filled with so much anxiety that I was having panic attacks. I was beginning to have mild hallucinations. I was self-harming, self-loathing. All those different unhealthy characteristics were coming out to where I really couldn't function. And so what ended up happening is I ended up self-medicating. And that self-medicating led to an incredibly horrific drug habit, which eventually led me back here to Fresno, where I was re-exploited again, right? I self-exploited myself again just because of the drug habit. I was so desensitized and detached from everything that had happened around me. It was really when they say some of these women and children we run across are like walking zombies. That's exactly what it is. So when we developed Breaking the Chains, we knew there had to be something beyond the rescue. And again, I don't want to minimize anything that anybody in this country is doing, but I mm-hmm. think that for me as a survivor, not just as a leader, it is so incredibly arrogant for people to believe that you could rescue a woman or a child from a situation that is this vicious, which quite frankly is the greatest modern day atrocity we are seeing domestically, and simply give them like a paint night and like, hey, let's rescue them. Let's stick them here in a place, give them some food and everything's going to be well. Talk to these officers and life's going to go on, because, or get them a job and that's all they need, right? Nothing's further from the truth.
You were a walking example of all of these wraparound services that needed to be done.
Absolutely.
And Miko, what's then needed to prosecute these cases? Because a lot of them happen. And then, as you said, not all of them actually get to the point of prosecution. You know, what are kind of the missing links there in some of these?
I guess the biggest missing link is the initial reporting. So, and that's something that if we could get the message out to anyone who is a victim of human trafficking, that they would be, and I think the tide is turning, but they would be respected. And we will work alongside the victims' advocates to make the criminal prosecution as least intrusive as it could possibly be, because we know it is a big ordeal unto itself. But we do really try to work with the nonprofits so that the reporting can actually happen. So whatever deterrent that they may have, whether it be fear, whether it be even the bond that they may have with the trafficker, that they can still work through that and report to law enforcement. But once that law enforcement report occurs, our office is pretty aggressive in how we prosecute. So if we can prove the case, and most times we have to, without the cooperation of the victim, or without her participation, and usually it's female, but trafficking happens to male victims as well. But if we can prove the case without the participation of the victim, we will.
And last year here in Fresno County was the county's first conviction of a labor trafficking case, correct? I mean, how momentous was that?
That was huge. And that was done by my partner. Her name is Lynette Gonzalez, and she's the other DA who works in our human trafficking unit. And that was huge. And that was one of those cases where it really took an entire village to get that case to trial. So that the case was huge, and it was a great success for our county.
And we know that labor trafficking happens here in this area.
It definitely does. And that's why I said it's difficult to say which occurs more, because the domestic sex trafficking is reported more. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, all facts and data show that the labor trafficking is actually occurring more. But there are just different hurdles and challenges to getting those reports.
So, you know, what has changed with all this added attention to the human trafficking problem over the last couple of years? I mean, are there any indications that the situation is changing or improving at all? Or are we still kind of getting a hold of just exactly what's happening in this area?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think I think the public is finally getting to have their eyes opened to everything that's going on. But I think at the same time, there's a movement, definitely movement going forward, because there's a message getting put out because of the prosecution and the amazing cases that Miko and Lynette have been able to prosecute. It's funny, and I'll be, excuse me, kind of ghetto when I say this, but I've heard law enforcement say, and I know you could probably attest to this, that in jail recordings and things, they're hearing other gang members tell other gang members, like, basically, this is a life case. You need to leave those girls alone. And so that's important. And I want to say, not to change the trajectory of what we're talking about, is when we're voting, whenever we're going to the polls, when we're talking about the new laws and all the new things that are coming into effect, we need to understand that our laws need to have teeth. Those teeth is what helps us prevent other children, not only from being trafficked, but individuals from getting into this. Trafficking is a business, just like drugs and guns and so many of these other criminal activities that are occurring in our communities. And because they operate like business, it's all about profit and loss, and it's all about risk and benefit, right? And so if we make the risk greater than the benefit, the likelihood of young men getting involved in this, we're saving too. We're saving the victims, and we're also saving our young men who potentially are looking at life sentences, if not death or more.
And some women do get involved with in trafficking as well, right?
They do.
Oh, absolutely. I have cases where we have female defendants. That is a new trend, in fact, that the women are trafficking. And one of the reasons that it can be sold like so successfully to a victim, because part of that fraud and coercion and telling the victim the initial lie, is that the violence that was present with the male may not be present with, right, the female. It seems like a glamorous lifestyle, then you can almost pervert it sense of feminism. Right. But in actuality, the violence is still there, and the detrimental harm is still there to the victim. It does not change as far as the consequences of the victim suffers.
And so then, Miko, you know, what do you think? Have you been able to witness any changes over the last couple of years?
I have, in the sense that there is a greater awareness of being trauma-informed and recognizing a victim as a victim and looking beyond what even a flat police report may tell you. It's changed with law enforcement. It changed with people who I speak with, and maybe they just don't want to say anything else in front of me, but it changes with people who I speak with, and they kind of get that understanding. What, though, troubles me the most, I think, when it comes to some of those changes is that in our community, there's still pockets where we haven't reached, and there's still almost systematic or institutionalized areas that we need to really focus on and educate. So a lot of my cases, and it's very even tragic to even recognize that these are our victims, but a lot of my cases are from group homes. And even though we've made efforts to educate those in the group homes and the staff, the fact of that circumstance doesn't change. So even with a criminal prosecution, one of the things, and that's why the mayor's initiative is important, was a coordination of services, but having services that are actually meaningful. So not just that you give somebody a list, a referral of doctors they can speak to, and then when you call the list, there's nobody who's available. Having actual services that are meaningful and they actually are effective. So I feel like we're at like stage one, stage two, but we need to bring it down to where in practice the victim is actually getting the services and resources that they really need.
And so last week, Mayor Lee Brand introduced a new human trafficking initiative. What does it do that's different from what your organizations and other agencies were already doing?
Well, what it does is it actually brings City Hall into the loop, which is huge. Right. It really does exactly as Mika was just stating. It brings that culmination in, makes sure that services that are being provided have a validity behind them and that people know where to go, what to do, and the process in which that takes, and make sure that that everybody's holding hands. One of my favorite things that the initiative brings is the data. Having cumulative data that is accurate, that is really showing what is going on here in Fresno, will not only help us begin to present a better look at to what we need to do and where we need to develop our services in the areas of focus, it's going to help bring resources here. I know before we went on air, Mika was talking about the potentially having a new task force formed within the police department and then having resources poured into other areas, some of our organizations, and begin to kind of get a look at what needs to be strengthened and what we're doing well. And that's going to be a great asset to us.
I think the significance of the mayor's initiative, I think the biggest part that impacts me as far as prosecution is having a team, organized team from the city that directly addresses all the things that were challenges and obstacles. So I'm really looking forward to not just the collaboration, but to, like I said, we really need the practical effect of everybody working at the same time doing the same thing.
I've been speaking with Mika Anderson, Senior Deputy District Attorney with the County of Fresno, and Deborah Rush, CEO and founder of Breaking the Chains. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for inviting us here.
Yeah, I'm incredibly honored to have been able to be a part of this today.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by my co-host Alice Daniel and reporters Monica Velez and Laura Tsui.
And my co-host, Carrie Klein. Technical support provided by Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.